Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by three artists that are participating in SOMART's annual Dia de los Muertos exhibit, which opens this evening, Friday, October 11th. And it's always really wonderful to be able to have such wonderful artists on the show to give us a little preview about what's in store for those of us who are able to get by the gallery. And this particular year, it's really special because they're looking at people that have made their transitions because they had cancer, or some people, you know, that are actually cancer survivors. So it's really, really a special type of art exhibit. And as I am just getting into the studio, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to ask the guests just maybe just, you know, to say hey and just give us their names and maybe talk about sort of the perspective that you're looking at for this particular exhibit. Some of you all are veterans, and you've been in the, you know, having something in this wonderful sort of gathering every year to sort of remember those that have made the transition. It's really important to remember our ancestors. So why don't we start? I believe, Carla, you're in the studio, aren't you?
Good morning.
Good morning. How
yes,
are you?
Yes, I am. I am doing great.
Yeah, I haven't talked to you in a long time. It's great to get together. When you have an exhibit, they don't get to talk to you. So why don't you tell us, Carla, what you're you know, focusing on this year? You've been a guest on the show numerous times, and you always have something, you know, you always bring something really provocative and insightful.
Well, many years ago, I worked as a medical illustrator, and this is a kind of a return to the medical illustration with my piece. I'm projecting in micrographic images and also sharing images related to things that cause cancer, prevention, with nutritional elements and to your food plan, and also honoring one of the persons that I've been doing a few Day of the Dead shows around is David Harold Blackwell, a former UC Berkeley department chair for the statistics department, and a worldwide, nationally, internationally known mathematician.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And your installation is called Death Stars.
Death Stars is named after the micrographic images that are being used in the piece. And it's just really captivating for people to see, you know, the composition of these pieces. But at the same time, I think that cancer, for some people, is kind of like this faithless, you know, entity, and a visually, you know, elusive entity that people are just devastated by. And I think the Death Star theme helps give them a visual on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. In the blurb about your exhibition, it says that you know, besides the images of cancer cells and environmental toxins, you also have commentary from doctors from the Harlem Hospital, reflections on holistic healing. And really, your piece seems to be a real investigation of just sort of this entity that when we all have, you know, these these cells, they're like fighter cells in our blood, and you know, we have the white cells, and they're supposed to be the ones that, you know, like our army, and yet you know, cancer, you know, it's sort of you know, it's like an invasion, and eventually it takes over, and it just seems like your exhibition sort of like it takes us into the realm of this, you know, disease in a way that perhaps people might not be aware of, and particularly if they're not in the medical field or affected or infected. And I also wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, as well as it says that you want to draw attention to the pollution and environmental causes of cancer. So maybe first, you know, with the doctors from the Harlem Hospital and Reflections on Holistic Healing.
Well, actually, the place where I started doing medical illustration was at Harlem Hospital, and then from there I went to the University of Miami at the School of Medicine. I was a medical illustrator there. And the physician that will be on hand this evening is Dr. Blackwell, whose father was the person that's being honored to teach. And they got 4 people in their family over a 10-year period died of cancer. And so she worked together with me on some of the researching, some of the cancer stuff. So she will be at the exhibit to share information about these different types of cancers that are shown in the cancer cells, the images of the cancer cells. And in addition to that, as far as the pollutants, I have images of smokestacks, and, you know, there has been some recent media attention with the Chevron refinery incident, where people are realizing that maybe they don't see those things, but they're out there as far as the things that can cause cancer as far as pollution is concerned. And I myself live in an area where we're surrounded by refineries, and so the incident that happened in Richmond really hit home. You know, from my window, I can see the refinery smokestacks from Martinez, Benicia, Pittsburgh, all around that area. And the cancer, the statistics, this is another thing that that's brought my attention to this issue, is the statistics are astounding when you look at the areas, like, for example, in New Orleans on the border with Texas. There are very high numbers of people that are affected by these pollutants that have cancer. And the, you know, media hasn't been real forthcoming with some of these situations. So I'm hoping to bring some attention to that as well.
Thank you. I want to let the audience know that we're speaking to artists who have worked in the current Dia de los Muertos exhibit at SOMART, and we were just listening to Carla Oden, and we're going to be talking to Martha Rodriguez as well as Adrian Arias. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. The SOMART Culture Center, Imagining Time, Gathering Memory, Dia de los Muertos 2013, is the 14th annual Day of the Dead exhibition, and it opens tonight with the reception. However, the exhibit is on view October 12th through November 9th, and it's dedicated to those whose lives have been affected by cancer. And the exhibition and program is curated by Renee and Rio Yanez. And this particular exhibition is just, you know, just a wonderful, institution in the San Francisco Bay Area community. For those of us who happen to live here, you know, it's definitely a pilgrimage every year to be able to visit, you know, this wonderful space. And it's a free space, so, you know, people can visit, drop by 934 Brannan Street in San Francisco during gallery hours, Tuesday through Friday, 12 noon to 7 p.m., and Saturday, 11 to 5, and Sunday, 11 to 3. So it's open every day except Monday. So, you know, people can just pop in. It's just really wonderful. And tonight is really special from 6 to 9 p.m. There's a $7 to $10 sliding scale admission cost. But at that time, as Carla mentioned, there'll be going to be more interactive. There's going to be performances and talks, and you'll be able to meet all the artists. And so it's going to really be special. So I want to let Martha Rodriguez share her work with us. She's a Chicana artist, and you're a leukemia survivor for 3 years.
That's wonderful. I am, yes. I was diagnosed with an acute form of leukemia in 2010, and I had 8 months of chemotherapy at UC Med Center, and then 2 years of oral medication, oral chemotherapy, which I just finished actually 2 months ago, so I was pretty happy about that. I felt like it was a huge accomplishment. And my altar is called Face to the Sun Remission in the Mission, because I have been in remission since I started chemotherapy, and it was a long, long road in terms of getting through all of the different types of chemo and testing and all of that. It took strength. And what I wanted to convey to people who have had cancer or in the throes of getting treatment is that there is life after going through all of this. And if you come out the other side and you are in remission, you can find a life that is actually quite beautiful. And you find that you're revitalized, basically, that one door was closed to the previous life that you had, and a new door is open, and that new life can actually be just so much more enlightening. So I wrote a poem called Mission in the Mission, and it's basically about enjoying simple things like taking walks with my dog, talking to people on the streets, stopping to feel the sun on my face or in my hands, appreciating the colors of flowers. And, I mean, very simple things, but it's a way of feeling that you're rejuvenating, that you're growing again. And also that, you know, with strength and finding a positive note from having such a terrible disease, it's possible to completely look at life as truly a gift, and that you appreciate every day. And it's sort of like I've taken the mantra of one day at a time, the 12-step program, because basically I feel at this point in my life is that I've gotten through each day, and I try and think about the positives from that day and let go of the negatives, which has always been difficult, but it's possible to do. And so basically it's just a celebration of my new life after the leukemia diagnosis. And, you know, again, that it can be quite invigorating and lovely. So that's sort of what my altar represents. So I'm hoping that people can get, you know, an appreciation from that and understand that it's not just a life sentence or a sentence to die, that, you know, yes, it's going to happen to all of us, but that you can appreciate what time you have left. And that's kind of where I'm at. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So your piece sounds really intriguing, Martha, in that your piece, Face to the Sun, it's a large and life-size sculpture of a woman with her head and hands facing the sun, welcoming its warmth. And it seems like it's an externalization of what you told us, but you referred to it as the goddess of remission.
Yeah.
And so it just sounds really, really celebratory and really beautiful.
Well, it is. And what happened to me was actually on one of my walks with my dog, I did at one point stop to feel the sun on my face, and it felt beautiful. And it was that I had been in the hospital for so long that I had forgotten what that warmth felt like. And so it was just invigorating. And so I want the message to be a positive one, And because it's actually quite scary, you know, to go through something like this, and it's very possible to take it to a place, your diagnosis to a place that is one of fear and negativity, and that's not really what I found. So I really want to be able to tell people you can have a life, and it can be a good one, and you can appreciate what you have around yourself. I mean, for me, I have a long marriage, I have children, I have grandchildren, I have incredible friends, and I have my artwork, and that is just a lot to celebrate. So anyway, it's just, I think that there needs to be a message out there to cancer survivors that life continues, and that it's not over when you think it is. So anyway, that's basically what I'm hoping to convey.
Right, yeah, and your installation is going to have lights, actually physical lights, shining on the goddess's face and hands representing this life from the sun. Installation space is an indoor space. You're going to have to recreate that light
with the lighting, and there is an actual light in her, in the head that's facing back, and in her hands as well. So, and then there's a photo of my dog by my side, because he's been an integral part of my recuperation and recovery, and then the poem Remission and the Mission, which basically explains the altar and the installation. So anyway, you know, I'm hoping that people will appreciate it and take it home with them and give them something to think about.
So so Martha, you're a veteran of this this annual event, and Carla, you are definitely a veteran. And then Adrian, I don't know if anybody goes back as far as 1999. Carla, do you go back that far?
I do, and when we first started, we were at the Mission Cultural Center.
Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts. And Adrian, you actually are collaborating with LaTanya, and you've created an installation for Trayvon Martin. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and your work?
Well, in past years, I honor my mother, who die of cancer, and this year I choose like a more big concept about cancer in society. And when I knew how Trayvon Martin dies, and after that the trial, I feel it's a cancer in society. It's the injustice. Trayvon was like my daughter age, like 17, with dreams, you know, like a very good kid. He saved the life of his father when he was 9 or 10. He likes life and dreams. He would like to attend the college and becoming an aviator or mechanic or pilot, and all those dreams are dead because injustice. And well, to visualize my altar installation, this is a giant hoodie hanging over the head of the audience. And it's the death of a dream. It's the idea of the dream of this kid is dead. But Trayvon Martin is not dead. It's the American justice that is dead. You know, it's why I feel it now. It's the cancer in society, the cancer of injustice and lack of justice in the case of Trayvon Martin, you know, part of this cancer.
That's great. Just with the three of you, it's really interesting because, Adrian, yours is looking at how cancer isn't that we as a community have a body, you know, that we are all participating in, and that body can get sick. And if you look at sort of the nature of cancer, let me talk a little bit more about the nature of cancer and how you make that parallel between, you know, the personal, you know, with your mother and the larger community, you know, with all of us, and how we're, you know, cancer is you know, is showing up in individuals, but it's also permeating our society. Maybe you can talk a little bit more, and Carla, and Martha, you can certainly chime in with regards to how cancer, how it speaks to our immune system, and maybe give us the parallel in society as what is the immune system?
Well,
what's its equivalent in society?
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like these bad cells that are making growing this cancer in society, like in Trayvon case, have the other side, was the good cells, and the good cells are the young people that pursue their dreams. And I know that because when I make this, when Tanya and me make this altar, I was thinking all the time in my daughter, because she is that kind of person that pursue her dream to be a musician, and she's in love in life, and you know, you can't stop that. That is a good cell in society. That is the most beautiful cell to continue alive in society. But the problem is in the other side is when the power and the justice take the dreams of those kids, and that part is not in our hands until we say something. And I'm trying to say something with my art. Well, I think it's the role of artists also to be involved in these things. Huh? Well,
Other comments?
I think that for me, when I look at cancer in comparison to what's going on today in the world, it's sort of like the fear of getting cancer, the fear of having cancer is, I think, reflected in a lot of societies. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings, ignorance, and fear of people that are lifestyles that are different from yourself. And I think that is, in terms of comparing cancer to what's going on today, I think it's a lot of it is based on fear and ignorance and the inability or unwillingness to sort of do a little research, find out more information, try and understand what it is that is going on around you rather than just reacting and being fearful, and which is sort of what I did in terms of understanding what I was, the leukemia I was diagnosed with, understanding what happened to me afterwards, so that I wasn't carrying around these bad feelings, and that I could therefore let go. But I think society, ones that are causing a lot of disruptions and misunderstandings, are basically, like cancer, fearful of it. And it affects a lot that of misunderstandings and, you know, the bad feelings and violence and all of that. So that's how I would compare cancer to society, what goes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Carla?
I feel that the environmental toxins that we're exposed to, that there's a political component to that, in that as it relates to society, at some level there has been a decision made that these toxins would be allowed
to permeate our environment. And when we look at in terms of some of the agenda items that are being made at the governmental level and at the corporate level, they actually know that people are going to have a negative health impact related to these toxins that they're being allowed to leak into the environment. And I think that the social and political component of that really kind of came out with this incident with the Chevron refinery. And there's been other incidences, but a lot of times it's not revealed unless, you know, catastrophic accident happens. But there are lots of people that, in terms of the politics of it, are being affected by decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the curator's right that Renee and Rio Yanez, they write that in the U.S., cancer remains the second most common cause of death, accounting for one in every four deaths. That's from Cancer Facts and Figures 2013. So that's a recent statistic and published by the American Cancer Society. And according to the American Cancer Society, cancer has become the number one cause of death in Latinos, now surpassing heart disease. And it was chosen by Renee and Rio Yanez as this theme, you know, Imagining Time Gathering Memory, Dia de los Muertos 2013, to encourage participating artists to imagine time in relationship to life and death and to utilize memories to create altars to honor the dead and celebrate life. And they also write, Renee continues, because cancer affects 25% of people in the United States, sooner or later we are all likely to know someone who has cancer. And I was talking to Idris Anifa Woshe Cooper last night, and she is publicist and media, something like that, person for Brava, for Women in the Arts. She's also a playwright and director. And she told me that there's going to be a benefit for Renee, I believe, at Brava later on this month, because October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, if I'm not mistaken. And that I believe he has cancer. Is that correct? Am I correct?
Yes, he does. He has bone cancer. And I think he was recently diagnosed 2 months mm-hmm. ago. So it's very hard. It's very hard. He's worked very hard his whole life. He's been such a creative force in our community. And so to know that he has been recently diagnosed is, it's hard. It's definitely hard. But he's mm-hmm. full of life and energy. You know, it's going to be appreciating that we have him. You know, we shall see what happens. So,
And on top of that, they've been recently evicted. I mean, when people think about the Mission District, San Francisco in general, you know, the face of San Francisco has changed drastically, and it's almost like a disappearing act the way, you know, communities of color are being systematically disenfranchised and leaving or being forced to leave San Francisco and the San Francisco Bay Area because of various economic reasons around property and access to property. So I was wondering if you could talk maybe in closing, if you have comments about that, certainly please feel free to do so. But also wanted to ask you all if you could comment on this sort of annual ritual that's sort of like the beginning of a ritual that happens throughout the Latin diaspora, but also happens, you know, in African communities and in other indigenous communities, the whole idea of honoring one's dead and creating altars. We haven't talked much about the altar and the ritual and the spirits and the invocation of those spirits and just sort of, you know, philosophically where you all are coming from around that. So there's really a holy place. Like when you walk into Somart, you know, one, it's like it's just a whole, like you walk in off of the busy street where there's a lot of commerce, and it's almost like stepping into another world. And then within the installation is a world within a world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe that by honoring the dead and also reflecting on this issue related to cancer, we can also look at what are some of the responses that can be an answer to a positive solution around it. And one of the things that I've been sharing in my installation is some information that's come through from the medical community as it relates to nutrition. And as it relates to the statistics around cancer, for people that are looking for some alternative medicine and also looking at, you know, the Gerson therapy and other therapies, there's a man named Pablo Areola that talk about using nutrition as a way to fight cancer as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just wanted to say I did not grow up with celebrating Day of the Dead, and I grew up in a family. I was born during a time where assimilation was really the norm, and I have to say my cultural education began in college. And so basically it's been from reading, from talking to people, and from basically experiencing on my own what Mexican traditions were. And I look at Day of the Dead as something that I did grow up with. One was that my father always spoke about dying when I was a child. You know, when it's my time and I get taken, I'll be ready. And I heard that constantly, and I thought that that was pretty much the norm in other families, only to find out that death was not something discussed openly, that it was actually quite fearful. So I realized that there was some cultural upbringing there, but I just hadn't been aware of it. And when I look at the Day of the Dead, I appreciate the idea of remembering loved ones, because in Latino families, in many cultures, you know, looking back at your ancestors and telling stories and sharing them is one way of keeping up the information about your family. And I've found that really important with my own children to pass on the family stories. And I can't say that I completely 100% agree with the tradition that spirits can come back, but I feel like I've left the door open, and I have had personal experiences where I felt loved ones close by. So to have that experience is enough to make me a believer that there is like a door that you can leave open, where if you are open to connecting with loved ones, it may be possible. So that's the way I look at it.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Adrian?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Your comments on any aspect of
about
and about remembrance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Day of the Dead in so much is a great opportunity to understand the ancient celebration of the Mexican celebration, the traditional altars, but also with this new view that contemporary artists put together to represent a new way to honor the dead. And there are many interactive pieces, like I saw some pieces using scannings and computers, but also pieces interacting with the space. You can go inside to like, spirals or inside objects. And in the case of my installation, you can sit down in a pile of red pillows. When you are there, you can see to the left or to the right, reflecting yourself in the mirror like infinite times. To be in the installation and feeling like a cell multiply infinite. There is many ways to express how honor death and life with the contemporary artists in Day of the Dead. And really, thank you, Rio and Rene, to put together this for 14 years.
Oh, really? Do you want to give the website?
Sorry?
You said it's something that you have something you've been working on. You said for 10 years, and it's on the web. You said.
Well, no, I thank Rio and Rene Yanez for putting together this in the last 14 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a lot of celebrations in town, but I understand that Rene Yanez started making the very first Day of the Dead like 35 years ago.
That's true.
Yeah, in Galería de la Raza, and it's very beautiful to have this new celebration, you know, because 35 or 40 years ago, this is a new celebration in town, you know, because it's a very ancient celebration in Latin American countries, especially in Mexico. You know?
And you're coming from.
Thank you for
You're coming from a Peruvian ancestry, right? So there's sort of we're looking at sort of a broader than people normally think about with regards to the Latin diaspora, and then in Acala, it's like you're a person of African descent. It's like so it's the way that this particular exhibition sort of looks at other cultures outside of the Mexican culture that people think about when they think about Dia de los Muertos. Because I went to Michoacán and for Dia de los Muertos many years ago, my daughter was a student at the University of Guanajuato. And that was just so beautiful, going out to the cemetery and people had their altars, and it was raining, it was pouring rain, so it was covered. The altars were like covered in protective fabrics and things like that, so that the fires wouldn't go out. But they were, you know, had the foods that their loved one enjoyed when they were alive, and the whole family was there, and it just went on, you know, until the next day. It was just really beautiful. And that's really, you know, recreated quite well in this particular annual tradition at SOMARTS. You know, this whole idea of community and celebration, and death is not a thing to fear. And when a person dies, you don't forget them. So it's just really, really beautiful. And I want to thank all of you all so much for, you know, continuing to participate in this great exhibition and to have this wonderful work that you've created for this specific 14th annual, and for joining us on the show. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So I'm gonna come tonight. I don't think I've paid, but this will be my second time ever coming to the opening. But now this is gonna be very special.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
Yes, so I look forward to seeing you, Carla, and to meeting you, Adrian and Arthur.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank
all
you.
Right.
Welcome.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All righty. We'll see you tonight.
Okay, definitely. Idris, is that you?
Yes, it is me.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Well, that was on the line. I didn't want to interrupt anything.
Oh, no, I know, but I wasn't certain if you were going to make it, so they didn't keep you for jury duty last week, right?
No, they did. Well, I had to call in each evening, and they passed me every time I called in. They said, call back the next day, so I didn't actually have to go in, and I'm excused for a year.
Oh, okay, so we're joined the studio with the Dream Akamore. Founder of Cultural Odyssey, and is
and I'm not
Kenneth
sure
Nash?
If Skyler is my student. Is Skyler there? Skyler?
Oh, is it?
Oh, he didn't make it.
No, not yet.
Okay. All
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe Skylar will be joining us a little bit. So you're joining us to talk to us about the community orchestra that you've been rehearsing, and the first performance is tonight, and I think there are like two more, and there's a big Cultural Odyssey first annual picnic and performance of the orchestra. Talk to us about the whole idea of having a community orchestra. That just sounded like really wonderful.
Well, it is wonderful. It's something actually I've always wanted to do a larger scale ensemble, and I've done that only briefly in the past. So when this opportunity came up, actually it came up through the support from the Irvine Foundation's Exploring Engagement Fund, which is a fund that allows for basically to engage participants who are a variety of demographics, everything from low income to professional and non-professional musicians, closet performers, just people that would want to perform. And you don't have to have previous musical training in it, even, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the idea was that my band, The Pyramids, which it's basically myself and Kenneth Nash is in the band, and Hashima Mark Williams and Sandy Poindexter, Abdul Wahid. We did 8 free shows in last February to kind of advertise the need for a community orchestra and to try to get students to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we wanted them to sign up for 12 workshops, which many of them did, and now we have almost a 30 member large ensemble orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and our first show is going to be tonight.
Mhm. Yeah. So are they performing music that the Pyramids composed? Did you all do any compositions? You create any new compositions as a community orchestra? What's going to be sort of the tenure of the opening performance?
Well, we used a lot of my own compositions as a kind of a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
inside the orchestra, we also have new compositions that were created specifically from the orchestra's workshop process. There's a piece called Music is a Healing Force of the Universe, which is our theme song.
Mm-hmm.
And that was composed that, and it was arranged by the orchestra in the process of the workshops.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
as well, each member, many of the members of the orchestra will be featured in their own original compositions that would be backed by various members of the orchestra.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about who's in the orchestra, you know, like the ages and the levels of experience, and over the course of, you know, how many rehearsals, how many classes, if you call it that, sort of tell us what developed and sort of how you and Kenneth approached this particular concept. And is it because of an experience that you all had as young artists or young musicians in the craft that you wanted to have a community orchestra? Like, why did you feel this was necessary to have people making music together?
Well, I just think that the whole idea of sharing information with other musicians and younger musicians that don't have as much experience, I'm from that tradition. I grew up in Chicago, and the Chicago there's an organization in Chicago called the AACM, which is the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, and you know, people like the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Moo Hall, Richard Abrams, George Lewis, Douglas Ewart, Nicole Mitchell. These are a lot of the musicians that are a part of the AACM. I kind of left Chicago before becoming a member, but their whole idea was that they would really provide workshops and training for inner city popular, particularly youth, and anyone who wanted really to have musical training. So the whole idea that we could be able to create a kind of a environment where we could all exchange ideas, where students that didn't have as much experience could learn from more of the experienced musicians like myself and Kenneth. There's also Hashima Mark Williams, who's like one of the main acoustic bass players in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he's also a part of the Pyramids. He's on stage and at all the workshops, so that a student, which I was hoping like Skylar Scoval, who is a bass acoustic bass player from the San Francisco State University in their music department. He's a part of the orchestra, so he's a young guy. You know, he's like, I guess he's 20, 21 or something like that, And so he's able to really learn and experience working with Hashima, And then there's a flute player named Jose Constantino, who is also kind of a beginning to intermediate flautist. And I've been giving him some training on basically technical issues for his instrument. So it's a really it's a wonderful exchange to pass on knowledge to anybody who wants to be involved in music.
Mhm. Yeah. Did you have a relationship with any of those master musicians that you mentioned around the AACM? Did you have any kind of relationship like that yourself when you were young in the craft, participating in like community-driven kind of workshops and things where you were able to be mentored by a more seasoned artist in the type of music that you were or instrument that you were exploring at that time? Because you play a lot of different instruments.
Well, I started taking individual lessons when I was very young, when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
I've been taking music instruments. But there was a time period during high school where I kind of laid off for like 3 or 4 years because I was involved in, sports. And I kind of reacted again. I didn't really even realize it at the time. But as you rebel as a youth, I kind of rebelled against, I don't want to take music lessons, and I'm tired of going and doing what my mother and father would like me to do, because I'm ready to just, party and play basketball and all that kind of stuff. So, but what that early training did for me, it really just basically permeated my being with music, unfortunately. At those early years, I wasn't around professional jazz musicians. I didn't know how I could apply all of that classical training that I was getting, all of that training on scales. I didn't know really how to. Let me form a. On my block in Chicago, there weren't like bands. I didn't know anybody, so I didn't have that kind of mentorship initially. So when I kind of rebelled against music, there was no one to say, well, look, Idris, you could really apply this classical training to jazz and our R&B or something. So when I came back to the idea that music was really what I wanted to do, by that time I was maybe 17 years old. That's when I found my master teacher in Chicago, and he was this amazing master of the clarinet. His name was Clifford King, and he mentored me for about 3 years basically training, getting my technical expertise together on the alto saxophone. And he was like an older guy. He was like he had played with Jelly Roll Morton in the 20s.
Wow!
Yeah. So he passed on a lot of knowledge to me to get me back into into my instrument. You know, me coming back, you know, coming back in my own way, in my own time, to playing music again.
Wow. So how did you happen to meet him?
It was strictly, you know, I was back in Chicago because I had went to a small college in Iowa, and I couldn't stand it. So I came back to Chicago and enrolled in a college, so Chicago Circle, which was like a campus downtown Chicago. And I just went through the yellow pages. And I saw, you know, music lessons, saxophone and clarinet lessons provided by Mr. Clifford King. And he was on the south side of Chicago around Martin Luther King, what used to be called South Park Boulevard, and I just called him, and I went down there and had my first lesson. It was just a quirk of fate that I found this amazing master.
Wow, I mean, that's amazing to have a lineage that goes back to Jelly Roll Morton. That's sort of like you got the beginning of time all the way forward almost, you know?
Yes, and I didn't even realize it back then. I mean, I just went to this guy, and he was an elderly gentleman that I had no idea who he was. All I knew was, you know, I was still a teenager myself, and he just had a small little studio in a basement, and I just stuck with him for several years, and then I found out later that he was really one of the foremost musical instructors for all of the heavyweight saxophonist in Chicago, and that he was, you know, from that tradition of the 1920s of when Chicago was the jazz capital of the world, and playing with people like Jelly Roll Morton. And I found all that later, many years later.
Wow, that's amazing. And then you look at your lineage. And the legacy that you have, you know, spanned, because you have quite a legacy, with your former organization, you know, here, Culture Odyssey, but even before that, you know, when you talk to us about the pyramids, when you all were on tour, and you know, you started here at home, you know, in San Francisco, and then toured, internationally, but you toured internationally before you came home. And did home season, and then went on tour again, you know, with your newest CD. That was really a wonderful conversation that we had. Was that last year?
Yes, it was last year. It's really quite remarkable. I look back at my legacy, and I look back at the whole idea that things can come around 40 years later and be instrumental in your present life, you know. And all those things that I did, all those things I did 40 years ago when I founded the pyramids back in 1972 with two Antioch students. And, you know, unbeknownst to us, you know, we self-produced three albums in the early to mid-70s that are now a real established legacy and have become like, you know, collector's items as well as classic, underground classic albums.
Which
has really kind of spurred the new interest in my music and in the music of the pyramids.
We just, you know, when you just talk about it, I was thinking, man, you all should make, somebody should make a movie of this, because you have so many of the artifacts, and then when you all, like, you have, I mean, it's almost like theater, but you know, there's music. But there's also, you're like sort of, I mean, there's like so much drama, you know, as well in the presentation. And that's sort of like a spinoff from AACM, you know, as well as the Art Ensemble, because that was art and, I mean, that was music, but it was also theater, you know, with the costuming and the dramatic performances, and you're a performance artist as well as a musician, so it's like, oh, my gosh. Oh, man, because the community orchestra, that's going to be really phenomenal. So, like, okay, so the pyramids, you know, step two or three, you know?
That's, yeah, it is. It is a, it's a very, I mean, it's a really quite a wonderful, basically a wonderful addition. And, I mean, there's
mm-hmm.
people also like Daria Now, who's a wonderful vocalist, a more, you know, established.
Yeah.
Daria's singing in it. Cheryl Scales, a wonderful vocalist from the South Bay.
Oh,
Cheryl Scales
yeah.
is singing. And then there's Melinda. We have almost five vocalists that are creating a kind of a chorus or their own kind of choir inside of the orchestra. So we have five. We have wonderful voices that are
mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. Yes.
Oh, give us some more names.
Well, there's of course, and then one of the names of a wonderful who is really not a professional. Her name is Sydney
mm-hmm.
Clemens, and she's just mm-hmm. you know, she's just a lover of music, and she has this little percussion instrument that she has always had. She's had from Kenya, and
mm-hmm.
you know, she's just in the orchestra, just loving playing, never really playing in an orchestra before, or never at least playing on this kind of a level. You know,
mm-hmm.
so, you know, she's a non-professional that's involved in the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
There's Marissa Mullion, who is also a wonderful vocalist, but she hasn't been performing for, you know, quite a few years, but she's now featured and is featuring
mm-hmm.
some of her music in the orchestra.
Wow.
You know, of course, Sandy, you know Sandy Poindexter?
Of course, yeah, violinist, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. violinist. She's taking a real mentor role in the orchestra
mm-hmm.
and is providing her
mm-hmm.
wonderful, wonderful talent.
Nice.
And yeah, and so
mm-hmm.
and then of course, how can I forget that the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, is
mm-hmm.
are all a part of the orchestra.
Really?
Yes,
the
whole Medea Project is in the orchestra. And they are playing percussion instruments that I've been instructing and teaching them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these ex-inmates, you have female community participants, and you have HIV-positive
mm-hmm.
women, and they're all
mm-hmm.
a part of the healing. Healing is a universe. Healing is the universe of music is a healing force. The universe. They're part
mm-hmm.
of the orchestra, playing djembe drums,
mm-hmm.
xylophone,
mm-hmm.
and percussions.
Wow, that's so amazing. That is really amazing. For our audience, we're speaking to Idris Akamor, who is sharing with us sort of the genesis for the Community Orchestra, which is having its first concert this evening at the African American Art and Culture Complex, Hall of Culture, that's the upstairs big room, 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco. That's tonight, Friday, October 11th, from 8 to 10 p.m., and it's a free concert, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, it is definitely free. And actually, we're going to be in the Burial Clay Theater because that's going to be the better space.
So you're
I know it says on the card
okay.
it was in the Hall of Culture, but we're going to be in the Burial Clay Theater, and it's free.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. And it's music is the healing force of the universe. So that's big. Yeah, it could be the world, but you got the universe. Like, oh my goodness, so that's more than Earth, right?
And we are more than the Earth. It's definitely, you know, we got to start thinking about ourselves more than just this small planet we're on.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And then mentioned earlier that Saturday, October 19th, from 3 to 5, at Petrero de Sol Park. Petrero and Army Street, Cesar Chavez now in San Francisco. There's Culture Odyssey's inaugural 35th anniversary picnic. And so it's going to be food and music and fun. And then I'll let you talk about that for a sec. And then on Saturday, October 26th from 3 to 5 at United Nations Plaza, that's an outdoor performance. That's Market and Hyde and Civic Center in San Francisco. There's going to be the closing performance of this particular season of the Community Orchestra. Do you want to talk a little bit about these performances?
Yes, the one at Potrero del Sol Park, because one of the purposes of this grant was to try to help to establish music in alternative spaces, you know, away from your normal, you know, quote unquote jazz clubs or music venues. And in reality, we don't have any many jazz clubs, right? I mean, jazz clubs are closing left and right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rossella's is closed.
It is?
Rossella's closed.
Gone?
Yeah, Rossella's is closed. Yes, it did. It's been closed for about a month or two. Yeah, he sold it. Yeah, he sold it. He sold the club, so it's closed down completely right now. And who knows how it will open and what kind of club it will be when it does open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then of course, Yoshi's on Fillmore is hardly having jazz. It's it's mostly pop and really R&B and, you know, so they've gone through a real earthquake of a situation where, you know, they were close to bankruptcy or this, that, or the other. But so the whole idea that as musicians we've got to find alternative ways to present our music, this gives us an option to present our music in park settings. You know, so that's why the Arcus is going to be playing at Trail del Sol Park, and we're going to ask people to bring picnic lunches and something to sit on, you know, a blanket, and we're going to all pray for good weather, and we're going to do this outdoor shows on the 19th at Trail del Sol Park, and then we're going to be at the UN Plaza on the 26th.
Right.
So this is another way, number one, to have an alternative space for our music, but to also to increase our audiences, to expand our audiences through free public performances in the parks. I mean, of course, San Francisco Mine Troupe has been doing this for years, of course, for decades.
Yes.
And so the idea that musicians could do this is a great idea. You know, that we open up the possibilities of presenting ourselves in different environments.
Yeah, well, you think about music in different environments, because there are a lot of solo performers in a lot of sort of different and innovative spaces, you know, like BART stations and, you know, the Embarcadero, you know, Center and, you know, I mean, you see musicians, you know, in a lot of alternative spaces, but this, you know, this is an orchestra. This is big. You know, there are, like, how many pieces?
It's going to be close to 30 people, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's not often you see an organized set of musicians of that magnitude in a public space. You know, particularly, I don't think I've ever seen a UN Plaza. And, you know, UN Plaza is like a staging ground for a whole lot of creative, revolutionary kind of work. I've never seen an orchestra in Union Square, not Union Square, but United Nations Plaza. So that's going to be pretty mind blowing.
Yes, because it's like a real, it's such an open space. You know,
it really is.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, people are going to like try to go find a parking spot and get out their cars.
All the real theater that's going down there every day that you see every day at the
Central
Plaza.
Yeah.
You know, you have all the real drama and the real theater. You know, all of our friendly homeless people and tourists coming mixing with tourists and everything.
Right, yeah, and you know, and creating a soundtrack for that, because, you know, there's already a soundtrack, but actually sort of opening up the soundtrack for other sounds, you know, like, again, organized sound, because that's what music is organized, because we have sound around us all the time. But it's organized in a way that we recognize it at its beauty, in a way that we don't necessarily recognize the sound when it's fragmented as beautiful, necessarily. I want you to talk a little bit in closing about the ritual aspects of this because the pyramids and Culture Odyssey and Medea Project and everything you do is connected to ritual, and it's connected to Africa and, you know, ancient Kemet and coming forward and going back, you know, that dialectic process. So we're wondering how you talk a little bit about the ritual and the whole idea of calling forth healing, you know, for the universe with this sound and this magic.
That is definitely what is at the center of the orchestra, and that's why the name is the Healing Force of the Universe. It wasn't haphazard. It was named that for a real important reason, and that reason is that, you know, the orchestra is there to support each other. It's what we call a non-competitive, and what it is a non-competitive environment, and it's a cooperative environment that we're there to help each other. We're there to comfort each other. We're there to heal whatever anybody is going through. We're there to heal through music that issue. And as an example is the concert tonight. We really begin the concert the orchestra begins it in a kind of with a universal prayer. We come into the auditorium playing a composition basically called, you know, Thank You God. And it can be thank you God, it can be thank you Allah, it can be thank you the Creator, it can be thank you to whoever is that personal, that spiritual entity in all of us that we want to give thanks for our own blessings, you know, and to continue to bless us all with safety and good health and positive spirit. And so we come in, the whole orchestra come in singing this prayer with bells and healing sounds. And we'll even have colors that will be happening with lights that will basically establish the environment for the concert in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. So you're like sanctifying the space and you're clearing the space when you come in.
Exactly. We're clearing the
space.
Oh,
that is so you, Idris. You're just so like purposeful. Nothing is by accident.
And we're asking the audience to join in. So as the whole audience will be singing. Thank you, God, oh, thank you, God, oh, thank you, God, oh, thank you. Thank you, God, oh, thank you, God, oh, thank you, God, oh, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. So they're singing in my morning voice this chant. The Medea Project, everyone, and the instruments are playing, and the flutes are playing, and, you know, the lyrics, and to continue the lyrics, thank you for the sunlight. Thank you for the moonlight. Thank you for the starlight. Thank you for your guiding light.
Wow, that is so beautiful. So are you all planning on making a recording of any of this so that people can take it home with them and put it in their CD players? Are you planning on making this available, the music?
I think that's the next step. We're documenting, we're recording all the shows, and we're videoing.
Mm-hmm.
We're videoing the show, and recording the show. So I think the next step would be to put this in a kind of a recorded format.
Mm-hmm.
So people could share.
Don't forget the movie, the film, the pyramids.
That's right.
It came from Chicago.
That's a great name. I have to remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then as you know, as you all march across the country or fly across the country or just think yourself across the country, these various projects can be a part of this film.
Yes. You know, we just came back from myself and Ashima with Babatunde. Mm-hmm. You know, remember Babatunde, right?
Babatunde Lee?
Babatunde Lee.
Yes.
You know, he's living in Wisconsin now, and with his wife, who's teaching at a Stout college, which is in Menominee, Wisconsin. But we just returned from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, because Redessa is going to be there for the whole semester, the whole spring semester. She's teaching at the University of Wisconsin.
Nice.
But
lucky,
the pyramids,
lucky them.
lucky them. But me, Babatunde, and Ashima, we went and we performed at the Chazon Museum for a traveling exhibition of the Romare Bearden Smithsonian traveling exhibition. We performed a trio at this wonderful museum for Romare Bearden, which is a wonderful exhibition of his work.
Wow, when was this?
This was just last week. This was just September 20.
Oh, gosh.
Just September 20.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, week before last. It was September 26.
Oh, wow. Well, that's awesome. That's my daughter's birthday, my younger one.
Okay.
Oh, interesting. Wow. How wonderful.
Yeah.
So the exhibit is traveling, which means it might come this way? And then you all can do that concert again?
That would be great. If the Museum of Modern Art or some museum here actually was going to host it. Yeah, but it's traveling, and it was at the Chazon, which is was a very wonderful museum in Madison on the campus of the University of Wisconsin there.
Oh, nice. Wow. I have to look that up and see sort of if they have it booked, if the tour is booked, so we can see where it's coming on this coast. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow, that
is
so awesome. Well, thank you so much, Idris, for joining us today. It's been really wonderful. And this weekend, for those who are sort of familiar with the Ma'afa commemoration, this week is our ritual, the 13th, which is Sunday, at Ocean Beach, pre-dawn. And because of the shutdown with the federal government, Ocean Beach is one of those places that they said is not public, doesn't have access to. But we're going to be there anyway because the ancestors are expecting us.
Okay.
So,
So
thank you so much for blessing us this morning with, your words and your work. And, gosh, I got to figure out how I can get over there for tonight. It's like, there's too much happening on one night.
Please come by, Wanda. You would be totally, I'm telling you, you have to be
there. I know.
The Madea Project.
I've got to go to something else early. Probably say it again?
Yeah, go to something else early, but come over there because 8 o'clock is going to be, something.
Oh, yeah, I know it is. Wow. But, the pyramids are so mythical, as structures, and then you think about sort of the sphere behind the structures, no one really knows how it happened because we weren't there. We can only imagine it.
That's right.
Yeah. As you all say, in one of your pieces, otherworldly, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Otherworldly.
So I was thinking about playing, because I still have some of your music in my studio, I guess, I don't know what you would call this part of it, but anyway, I've got music. But I'm not getting ready. So I was thinking I could play Otherworldly, which I thought was kind of neat since I mentioned it. And then I was thinking after that I could play Ritual 1, just because it sort of will put people in the space for tonight. What do you think?
Yeah, that'd be fine. That'd be really nice. That'd be great.
Okay,
I'll be
cool.
Listening.
All right. Thank you so much, Idris.
Okay,
look
Wanda,
forward to seeing you this
hope
evening.
To see you tonight. Okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm going to make it happen.
Okay, please. You won't regret it, I'm telling you.
I know I'll never regret. I don't regret anything that you all are connected with.
Okay.
All righty. Peace and blessings.
All right. Peace and blessings.
yeah, 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 yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the Pyramids, and I'm a little out of breath. I had to run upstairs at the college where I teach. I was sitting outside because I needed a better signal, and now my computer is dead, darn it. So I gotta find some electricity so I can say, so I can play this wonderful interview with the director out of New York, but really out of Lagos. Or out of Nigeria, by way of Lagos, but out of Nigeria, by way, out of New York, by way of Nigeria. Sorry, got it kind of backwards here. And his latest film is actually going to be having a limited engagement at the Opera Plaza cinema in San Francisco, but it's opened quite a few places in across the country, and it's called Mother of George, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful movie. It is just so fantastic, and it's a collaboration between him and wonderful screenwriter, and they were right together at the Sundance Lab, and they've been shopping the film for quite a while, and now it's finally out, and certainly all good things, you know, have their time and place in this film, which is it's contemporary, but the story is universal. Is quite magnificent. So I am talking while my computer reloads, because like I said, it ran completely out of juice. And so while I'm talking, I want to let you know that I'm not actually going to be able to play a rebroadcast of the conversation with Robert Hillary King and Marina Drummer about Herman Wallace when he was still on this side of our shared collective consciousness. Since that interview, he actually made his transition, but not before he was released, exonerated, released from prison. So he died, you know, in the arms of his loved ones and supporters, which is really great. And tomorrow, Saturday, the 12th, the day before his birthday, or his Earth Day, he is going to be memorialized and interned in New Orleans. So if you're in town, you definitely want to try to catch a second line and pay your respects to this wonderful man who gave his life for the people, literally. So let me read you a little bit about our next guest, who I was able to have on the air, have a telephone interview with yesterday, because he is just so in demand. wonderful film that he has created. So let me tell you a little bit about him, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the film, and then we will go ahead and play this interview. Looking for my notes, which I'm not seeing that quickly. Darn it. Let's see. Okay, well, let me tell you about the film first, and then I'll get to my notes about the director. So the film is about Adenike and Ayodele. Ayodele, the actor, Isaac de Bankole. So both Adenike and Ayodele are a Nigerian couple living in Brooklyn. following the joyous celebration of their wedding, complications arise out of their inability to conceive a child, a problem that devastates their family and defies cultural expectations, leading Adenike to make a shocking decision that could either save her family or destroy it. And so the director, Andre Dosunmu, Restless City is his feature debut, captures the nuances of this unique and fascinating culture by creating a beautiful, vibrant, and moving portrait of a couple whose joys and struggles are at once intimate and universal. So let me, without further ado, play this wonderful interview with him. His background, the director's background, he was a fashion photographer for Live for Eyes of St. Lawrence, and he's also done a lot of album photography for really famous artists like Isaac Hayes and trying to think which Neville brother. I'm drawing a blank right now on which Neville brother, but the one that comes here a lot, Aaron Neville, and Tracy Chapman, Erykah Badu, Tyler Quale. He's also, shot music videos for some of the artists. And in his Restless City, just from looking at it, there's a little bit of a hip-hop flavor in that. And actually, when he talked about his cast and his real creative way of casting, because it seems as if, he had particular people in mind and didn't settle for others when he knew, who would basically be able to bring a particular character to life in the way that he wanted to see it brought to life. So real tenacious and self-determined director, as well as skillful with that camera. Oh my goodness, the film is just so luscious and so beautiful. It's just a feast for the eyes, and the story is a feast for the soul. And the way that the story ends is actually things are not settled, which is kind of great. I mean, we don't feel that the story is left. We're left hanging necessarily, but as in life, and the people are still living. The resolution, you can't resolve an issue because life goes on, so to speak. So anyway, definitely we're able to, in our imaginations, try to figure out sort of what happens next. But definitely this journey, Mother of George, is one that's really delightful and really, really happy to have gone there. So don't forget, tonight at Landmark Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, 7 o'clock, Mother of George opens for a limited engagement. I don't know what limited engagement means, but definitely it means that it's not going to be there forever. So you need to get to Landmark and check it out. And a lot of times when films have an overwhelming response, they are kept on. So is also there. If you remember, we had an interview with the director, and she is Haifa Al Mansour, is the first female filmmaker in Saudi Arabia, and we had her on the air to talk a little bit about Wajda. And so this film has been there for a while, so and I'm sure it's there because people are seeing it, and so get on over to Opera Plaza Cinema and check out Mother of George and tell all your friends, because we want to keep on seeing films like this made, and these kind of films, don't get the funding and the kind of support they need if people don't go see them. So, that's the way we let those that are funding such artistic endeavors know that there is a market for them, because, it feeds our soul, but a lot of times that's not necessarily enough of a reason to fund a venture that has to also make money. So here's our interview with director of Mother of George, Andrew Dosunmu. So first I want to just tell you that Mother of George, it has a lot of twists and turns, the story. Yeah, and it is just so beautifully rendered. It's just a gorgeous film. I mean, the colors.
Thank you.
the light. I mean, the way you have the characters, there's sort of some I guess some of the frames, they're like almost like washed out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the light. And then others, you know, you play with another way, you just show us like the real deep richness of the textures and the colors, you know, juxtaposing, you know, the fabrics with the skin, with the, you know, the street, you know, scenes and everything. It's just a really lovely film.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful. And then I just love the ceremony. Oh, my goodness. The opening, you know, with the wedding. Why don't you talk a little bit about shooting an African film in New York? I mean, it's like, wow. You wouldn't even know you were in New York a lot of the time.
I mean, for me, it's never really even a question. You know, I live in New York. I'm in New York. I've been here for, you know, nearly 2.5 decades, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting for me because obviously the story is universal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just culturally specific, but the story is universal. So it's just really I love the story, and I thought it would be wonderful to sort of set in this community, which we don't often see in American cinema. You know, we've seen great American cinemas from The Godfather to Esther Street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all deal with, you know, some sort of immigrant experience, whether it's the Italian immigrants in Godfather or Turkish immigrants in Eli Kazan, America, but never the African experience. And I thought it would be really interesting to sort of depict that via the story. So that's what I was trying to do. I mean, often when you see New York in cinema, you know, you get the Woody Allen New York, you know, but you don't really see these other migrants, you know, this, you know, people of African descent that created their own oasis in this metropolis. You know, you go to some parts of New York and, you know, you might as well be in Kingston or Dakar or, you know, any of those metropolis, and you don't really see that in cinema. So for me, it was just an opportunity to paint that and to depict that.
Yeah, well, you do a marvelous job. We are definitely transported. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the story, because this particular work was a collaboration between you and the screenwriter, and you all worked on it collaboratively in like an incubator at Sundance. Can you talk a little bit how that worked out?
I mean, it was great. I mean, obviously, when I first read the script, I really like it, and I liked something about it. I like the universe. There's something that connected me to the script. It wasn't accurate, and it wasn't authentic enough for me. And when I spoke to the writer, she was very, very open to that. So we kind of, you know, I give her my 2 senses, and I know the culture better. She loves it as a woman, as a European, as a, you know, Anglo-Saxon woman. She can relate to the story as a woman. I relate to it as an immigrant, as an African. So it was really wonderful to sort of be able to collaborate. And going to Sundance was a great opportunity because we were able to be in the space and just evolve on it and develop it. Obviously, we tried to do that for a while. We had the movie for a while, but we couldn't get the finance for it. So I had to put it on the back burner for a minute and do something else. But that's how it all started. That was really the genesis. She brought the story to me, and I really liked something about it. And it wasn't even set in a Nigerian community, but I reckon I could enrich it. And I've always wanted to do something set in that community, in the immigrant community of African diaspora. So it was a great opportunity for me to kind of bring the story in and set it there. And I really wanted to show the culture, the elegance, you know. This is what's on screen is not, it's not really something that I invented. You know, these are thousands of years history, you know, the wedding, you know, this is something that's happened for thousands of years, whether the wedding ceremony or the way the people are culturally, elegantly. It's not my invention. I just had an opportunity to capture it.
And it's really interesting, though, that considering that, I mean, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a large Yoruba community. I mean, huge, and, you know, as well as Igbo and other, not as much Hausa, but other communities. But I mean, a real, like, you know, it's really something, like, it's real tangible. The West African.
Well, you need to get it out to them. You have to
Oh.
Get those people to come out and support the film because it's very important that we get these kind of films out there and they get to see it. So please.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm certainly going to be letting everyone know sure, you know, that, you know, this film is, you know, going to be screened at the Mill Valley Film Festival. But I was also wondering with regards to, you know, just sort of bringing in you know, the Yoruba, the Ifa tradition, you know, having, you know, mentioning, you know, Oshun and having, you know, the way that the young wife, who is marvelously portrayed, by, your actress, she is just, how do you pronounce her name?
Denai Guerrera.
Yeah, she is like, oh my God, she is so beautiful and she is so good. Yeah, and then the synergy between she and, you know, and her husband, you know, the famous, how do you pronounce his name, Isaac?
Isaac de Bancole.
Yeah, it's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, I mean, the casting is just phenomenal. But, you know, just sort of bringing in those elements of authenticity, you know, the fruit, you know, the sweetness of the pineapple and the, you know, and then you bring in the textures of the banana and talking about that in relationship to the relationship, it was just like, wow.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, like I said, you know, it's something that's existed for thousands of years, and this is how, you know, what people have, you know, this is how the culture celebrates celebrates situations like that.
Mm-hmm.
And for me as a filmmaker, I think it's very important that people see that we exist prior being here 700 years ago, you know. We had a history, we have strong history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, audience need to know that, American viewers need to know that, African Americans, we have to know that our history predates slavery. We have strong history, we have strong culture,
mm-hmm.
And that's very important.
Yeah. I was wondering how would you, if someone asked you, what's this film about? You know, we've talked about, you know, it's about family, and definitely it's about a loving relationship between...
It's a love story.
Yeah.
It's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a love story. It's really about what one does, at what price one pays for who we love.
Mm-hmm.
What are the prices we pay for the people we love? And they're all trying to pay a price. They all think they're doing what's right. From the brother-in-law to the mother-in-law, to the husband, to the wife, they all believe they're doing what is right for the family. So it's a love story. They're all sacrificing something for that family, not knowing that it might go a certain way. And it's totally understandable as a mother-in-law. It's like that the matriarchal character. She wants a lineage. She's in a new world. And often when people migrate or, you know, immigrate somewhere else, they really want to kind of... what they have left is really creating that lineage because they know it will die right there. And that's what the mother-in-law is really trying to, that's what she's striving for.
Mm-hmm.
So she really believes she's doing what's right. The brother B thinks he's doing what's right for the family. And so it's a love story. It's really about what we go through,
mm-hmm.
what we'll care about.
Yeah. And it's also about, you know, sacrifice because, you know, the protagonist who brings, you know, the woman over, you know, whom
mm-hmm.
he loves, and, you know, that's like the one thing he does for himself personally because he brings over his brother,
mm-hmm.
you know, his mother, and then finally, you know, his true love. And yet the film also seems to be about choices and sacrifice and how sometimes people in your life think that they know what is best for you, even if you don't agree with them necessarily, or
mm-hmm.
yeah, like
mm-hmm.
eventually you might agree with them, but you don't agree with them while they're in the process necessarily
mm-hmm.
of trying to convince you that this is what you need.
I mean, it's funny that you said that because, you know, that's the reason why the lamp is there, you know,
uh-huh.
the sacrificial lamp, you know. So it's really funny that you said that because I always felt like if I didn't name this movie Mother of George, I'll call it The Sacrifice, you know.
Mm.
And that's what the lamp is there for. It's kind of an allegory, you know, of of what's going on, you know, mm-hmm. sacrificial lamb, you know, the brother gets sacrificed,
yeah.
The lamb gets sacrificed for what they've got,
mm-hmm.
for the joy, and so those things, you know, and when you talk about the indigenous African religion, like the Ifa,
yeah.
it's all about that, it's all about giving, you know,
mm-hmm.
Giving to nature, you know, sacrificing, getting back, you know, whatever you get. Pay back for it or offer back for it. It's about offerings.
Mm, mm-hmm. Ah,
and,
yeah.
and I really wanted, you know, and I really wanted to kind of depict the fact that, you know, in those cultures, in those traditional cultures, the religion, the acceptance, you know, the very, very, the acceptance of other religion, you know, they all coexist.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Islam or Christianity, it all coexists under those traditional religion. They don't have, they never anti it. They take it, they embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in the film, everything is reflected. Every kind of religion is reflected because they all coexist.
Mm-hmm.
You go to church and you worship the Ifa, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You go to mosque, you go to the altar.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you show that too. You show the integration of spiritual traditions,
mm-hmm.
Islam and Ifa and Christianity is there, and it's like, and it's all getting along really well. You know, for the good of the family and for the good of the people that are you know, participants in this particular path, on this particular path. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, since we mentioned, you know, two of your, you know, stars, I was wondering if you could talk about the cast and how you were able to, you know, pull together such a wonderful one. I mean, they're like famous. I mean, really, really famous. And they're just, you know, so striking with one another, and the relationships that, you know, that the story is based on are just so strong because of the characterization as well as the embodiment of these wonderful actors and actresses. So why don't you could talk about sort of how you were able to pull this apart? I mean, pull this together. Did you have a lot of money, or you just knew them? I just
money we did not have. I just sort of started, really. It's like I have worked with Denai before on my last film, Mother of George, and you know, while working with her, I just realized that she's a phenomenal actress, and there's so much more that I wanted to explore. So I was really excited. I mean, when this project originated, when we started this project about four or five years ago,
mm-hmm.
I never even thought about it. She never even came into the equation. But after working with her at Restless City, she was just really amazing. I mean, she was just a gifted being, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to explore that. I did vow to myself that if I'd get another opportunity to make another film, I really want to play with her in the sense of exploring,
mm-hmm.
That. And then Isaac de Bankole is somebody that I've always known. I've seen him in French films since I was in my late teens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's this actor I've always admired in all this in the films of Claire Denis, French film director of Claire Denis, or Jim Jarmusch. I've always just had this amazing, because it's striking and it's demeanor, and it just reminds me of so many people that, you know, men I know.
Mm-hmm.
When I had the opportunity, it was definitely him, to go out to him if I could get him. And then the mother-in-law, Miss Buki Ajayi, she's a veteran Nigerian actor from the 70s, and she's amazing, and I knew her from growing up, from watching TV. So,
wow.
From watching TV, so I tried to actually... She was never in the equation because I really wanted to cast her. I was casting in New York, and the most actors I was seeing weren't just giving me that, you know, they weren't giving me that depth, that fierceness,
mm-hmm.
that sureness. You know, they all questioned this character, why, you know, and I just didn't get it. So for me, I had to travel to Nigeria and convince her to come here and shoot this film, because she did not want to come. You know, she's like, "We don't want to go do this. It's cold and all that stuff." She did not want to come, but I was able to convince her, which was great. And Tony Okungboa, the younger brother.
Yes.
I don't know if you recognize him from the Ellen DeGeneres show.
Oh.
He's the DJ on Ellen's show.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. And Tony, hello? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, Tony's the DJ on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And Tony, I have created a relationship with for years, and he was in my last film, Restless City 2. So it's just really creating relationship and working with people and understanding each other. And that's how it all came together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about Ade Nike's good friend?
And then there's Yaya Da Costa, which is playing Sade,
yeah.
Ade Nike's friend.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, and Yaya is amazing as well. I mean, mm-hmm. And for me, it's really about trying to talk about that kind of using the film to kind of really depict that sort of triangle, that, you know, generation, yeah, the first generation, second generation that is born in America or raised in America, and the people that came from the country of origin and the difference, the way they see things.
Mm-hmm.
So is Yaya as well, which is a phenomenal actress, and was just wonderful to work with them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's got really, her character is so understanding of both worlds, you know, the old
mm-hmm.
world and the new world, and how difficult it might be to, you know, leave one and be expected to adapt to the, you know,
mm-hmm.
the old world to the new world, like without any kind of orientation and any kind of time to, like, sort of get your feet, you know,
mm-hmm.
get your grounding. Like, okay, you were here and now you're there, and okay, let's work it out. But then Ayodele,
mm-hmm.
Adenike's, what he finds attractive about his wife, his fiance, and then his wife, is that she
mm-hmm.
does carry the old stuff, you know, because
mm-hmm.
he misses that.
That's what he wants. That's
yeah.
what he wants. He
yeah.
understands that, and that's why, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the funniest thing is, you know, that completely, he wants that, you know, and, I mean, she feels, what I really love about her, Adenike, is that when she decides to do this, she's unapologetic about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's going to do it, and she's going to stick to it, and because she believes, it's really about her. She believes that she wants to give this to this man as a woman. It's not because the man wants it.
Mm-hmm.
She's not pushed to do it when she decides. Like, there is a man that's been waiting for me, and I feel like this is what I can give to this man. I want to have this baby.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say in the film, he says, it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah.
It will come when it comes. But
yeah.
for her, she just feels like that's her duty in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She said that's one thing she wants to share with this man. And I think to understand that is really to understand why she goes through that eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then that's the old school part of her. That's the old world, because she is closer to his mother and to her mother, you know, in that type of thinking than she is to Sade or Yaya's character, who is, you know, there are these different options. What about adoption? You know, that's an option.
Mm-hmm. And that's a question as well. You know, I mean, for me, it's really a question. What about adoption? I think it's great, but, you know, for me, it's always about how things, you know, the dialogue between, you know, tradition and modernity,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
and how things are, there's solutions for things for centuries,
mm-hmm.
you know, for centuries they've had this problem of fertility, and they find a way to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we go to the hospital, we adopt, you know, go and get,
mm-hmm.
go to the hospital and get a tube or artificial insemination or all that stuff. We do it nowadays, but they've had a solution and they feel like that solution is probably safer because, you know, when you go to a sperm bank, you don't even know the genetic problems of that sperm, you know, you don't know what it carries. But when it's family, you know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's your brother. It's going to look just like you. You know the genetic problems. You know everything. So it's really a question, you know. It's about really questioning things. It's not really about what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about us questioning things and not discarding them because we think it's old or it's unoccidental, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like what you said. It's the dialogue between tradition and modernity. That definitely is sort of where the tension is in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this dialogue, and it keeps it sort of traps. Is it, how do you pronounce it? Bie? Is that how you pronounce?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It sort of traps him because, you know, he's indebted to his brother who doesn't hold anything over his head. But his brother's the reason why he's there. His brother has a restaurant. That's why he has work. You know, he's fed him and sheltered him until he got on his feet. And so he, like, feels indebted. It's like, okay, well, yeah. And of course, you know, love is there too. But there's, like, honor and responsibility, and then there's love.
Exactly.
Yeah, really, really interesting. And then I wanted to make another couple of comments about, you know, your wonderful character, Ayodele, that he is, you know, sort of a model, hard-working man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So simple pleasures, you know, will make him happy. You know, he's just such a wonderful, simple pleasures will make him happy. I mean, he's like, he doesn't want a whole lot. He's just, you know, just a few things will make him happy. He's got a wife that loves him. He's got good friends. And he's got, you know, his business where his wife doesn't have to work. He can take care of her. He can take care of his mother. You know, he can provide work for his brother. He's got friends. I mean, what else could a man want? And how often do we see these?
Folks can't have it all. We can't have it all.
Exactly. And so how often do we see African men in the cinema that are so positive? All of them are. Every last man in the film is like, you know, like, wow, these are good guys.
Well, it's very important to me. I think Emma always find it very important that we have to, you know, and that for me is really, it was very crucial as well in telling the story, is that often stories, you know, it's just really depicting the complexity of who we are and not just one kind of people. You know, often when you see an African character on the big screen, it's always, you know, we know what that is, you know. They're always kind of depicted one-dimensional. And for me, it's really to talk about, it's really to just reveal people I know. And that's very important, you know, that we show different complexities. So to show that that vast of us as beings.
Yeah. So, are any of these characters based on a little bit of your person, your personality? I mean, do you see yourself in any of these characters?
Hell no. None of them. None of them. They don't even look like me. If you meet me, you'll know.
I don't mean physically. I meant like
characteristics. Yeah. Character-wise, you know, they just, no, not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
Not at all. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But what kind of man
I probably want to be the opposite, you know.
Okay. Yeah, you know, wow, just, you know, sort of reading some of your bio, you know, that, you know, you come from a photography background, which sort of explains why your film is so beautiful, because you've got an eye, you know, for
that
kind of lens, and, you know, and movies are just moving pictures, right? Literally. and then you have, you know, this cinema and television background, and you're also, you know, you've done music video shoots, and fashion is, I mean, you can see all of that in this film. And I was just wondering, you know, your first feature film endeavor was Rest of City, you know, 2 years ago, and you got, you know, 1999, you got award-winning documentary Hot Irons, got the best documentary at Fest Paco, and Real Award in Toronto, and, you know, you direct a television series in South Africa, was it Yizo? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about, you know, sort of, you know, who are you? Like, you know, talk to us a little bit about your background, how you came to, you know, moving from, you know, these variety of genres to come to film, and you were raised in Nigeria.
Yeah.
So, you, I don't know, this nostalgia that, you know, your character has, And he actualizes it in his wife and his choice of a partner. You know, that comes from, you know, you're having an authentic relationship with the culture.
Mhm.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your aesthetic.
Oh, well, about me, oh God, I don't even know where to start with that. I mean, aesthetically, I mean, I'm someone that I'm really a worldly person, you know. I'm a citizen of the world. I'm happen to be an African. That's who I am. I mean, that's you know, unconsciously or consciously, very, it influences what I do. I want to celebrate that because I, you know, it's a culture I know and it's very, very rich. And I became a filmmaker because I wanted to depict people I know because I didn't really see them in cinema on the big screen, and that's one of that was one of my objectives. So, who am I? I'm a person trying to make films, and I'm a filmmaker. I want to tell stories through celluloid. That's who I am.
Yeah.
You know?
So what was it like, you know, growing up in Nigeria? Did you go to boarding school? Did you live in, did you go visit your relatives in the village? Did you live in the big city? What were your, who were your mom and dad?
Well, the, Nigeria, it's, I don't know if you know Nigeria, Lagos is a very big, big metropolis, you know,
mm-hmm.
metropolis. Yeah, it's a big metropolis. It was
huge.
You know, I mean, that was it. I was, you know, I was actually born in England. I was raised in Nigeria because my parents wanted their kids to grow up in Nigeria.
Okay.
Yeah, and went to school there, and mm-hmm. I was formed and shaped there. And everything I know, it's from there, you know, my love for art, my love for, you know,
mm-hmm.
my love for the arts, and, you know, I'm surrounded by it, you know, there was, you know, theater groups in every corner, and, you know, mm-hmm. every scenario is, you know,
mm-hmm.
every object or scenario is a form of art, so, yeah.
Yeah, so were there any particular, you know, artists that kind of inspired you, you know, when you were younger, that sort of, like, mentored you either directly or through their work?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of people. I mean, I won't say directly, they won't say mentorship, but they were very influential. I mean, African literature as a start, you know, it's a big influence in how I look at things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Africa has been able to produce some incredible literal minds, you know, from the Ngugu to the Soyinka to the Achebe. So definitely literature was definitely something, you know, that was very influential in my life, pretty much. You know, the African Writers series, all that stuff would be what I would think, you know, if I had to think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Influential.
Yeah.
You know, life scenarios. It's very, it's pretty influential, you know. But if I had to kind of, you know, really be specific, I'll say literature, you know.
Oh, really?
African
okay.
literature for African writers.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Which ones? And any, like a few that...
Yeah, like I said, Ngugi.
Oh, yeah.
Wole Soyinka.
Uh-huh.
Ngugi, Wole Soyinka, Chinua Achebe.
Okay.
It's actually even the contemporary writers, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? This is really interesting because the probably the people that are influential, like, in my life are actually really are my contemporaries,
mm-hmm.
you know, people like Chimamanda Ngozi,
mm-hmm.
She wrote Afro the Yellow Sun and all that, America,
mm-hmm.
Painters,
uh-huh.
you know, someone like Yinka Shonibare, which is a sculptor,
mm-hmm.
Chris O'Philly, people like that, you know, contemporaries, you know, are
yeah.
very influential. Then you get people like Ben Okwi,
yeah.
the writer,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, you know, Amos Tutuola, the writer, they're very influential because, you know, especially those writers were just, you know,
mm-hmm.
incredible.
Because you mentioned, you know,
the way to dive into that world.
Right, yeah. Did you mention that Ma Ayo Balogun?
Mm-hmm.
Balogun? Yeah, she played the mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how you went to Nigeria, you went to Lagos to convince her to come over here and shoot the film. I'm like,
yes.
Wow, that just shows you how continental you are. Like, you are going back and forth, and you want a person, you know, like you go get her.
That's what it is. If the actor happens to be in Norway, then I'm in Norway, I think my work is really, I'm really interested in this thing of, in this notion of border, and what's a border, you know? What's a border? The whole notion of border, you know. I'm someone that, you know, I've kind of, you know, grew up in four continents all my life, and I'm, you know, so I'm not necessarily confined to just one. And that question of borders, I'm really fascinated. It's something that I've always been.
Yeah. So what kind of, what,
you know, as these characters, they're beyond their borders, you know. This is their place. This is what they, this is their home. You know, the old notion of America, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I just think about, you know, sort of the fluidity of your aesthetic and of your sort of philosophy around art and art making. And then I think about the name of this film, Mother of George, and George, you know, Jim is a King George, right?
It's biblical. Biblical, you know, the sacrifice of Isaac, you know?
Okay. Yeah, all these layers is so fantastic. I wanted to mention, currently at the Museum of the African Diaspora here in San Francisco, there's an exhibit featuring the work of J.D. Ojai Ojekere. Is that how you say it?
Oh, Ojekere, the photographer.
Yeah, and it's
Phenomenal photographer. Beautiful,
right.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Elegant
portraiture. Exactly. And I thought about that when I was looking at the women and their beautiful, you know, sort of wrap.
Edu, yeah.
Oh my, oh, edu, is that how you put, that's what you call them?
You know, the edus, yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal. And then this particular exhibit is curated by another photographer that you probably know, Olabisi Silva.
Oh, yeah, she does the contemporary art,
She's
a curator, yeah.
So people can sort of like, you know, sort of get enriched in a couple of levels. You know, they see your film, and then they go to the exhibit and see the art.
Exactly.
Yeah. So my last question, or last two questions, I have to do with, you know, your films. I haven't actually, this is my first time seeing your films, one of your films, and definitely I'm going to look you up and see if I can find these other ones, you know, Restless City, The African Game, and Hot Irons. Well, I was just wondering, you know, as, you know, sort of in this realm of cinema, do you see each film as sort of an extension or thematically another chapter of the same story, or is each totally different? How do you sort of approach you know, each new project, so to speak?
Oh boy, in that sense, I think it's just something that I gravitate towards at that moment in my life, really. That's what it is. It's not chronologically or anything. It's just something that inspires me.
In that moment. Okay.
You know, whether it's Hot Irons and going to Down South and, you know, documenting all these young men that are hairdressers, or the spirit of football on the continent. It's really about what just inspires me. And I mean, if anything, I would say it's celebration. You know, I like to celebrate things.
Nice, yeah. And are you working on any new films? You said with this particular film, it took a while to get it out there. Are you an artist that has several projects in the air at the same time, and you just sort of...
No. At the moment, for example, I'm really enjoying I'm really in this world. I'm enjoying Mother of George. I'm trying to stay in the moment and enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
cool.
Teacher is not given.
And so how do the other you know, the creative team, what do they, how do they feel about the film? Do they, and do they think, do they like it?
I think so. I think we all enjoy the process and we enjoy making things. I mean, that's the bottom line. We like to create and we enjoy it.
Right.
And that's what it is, you know. We all get together as artists, and filmmaking is a collaborative effort, you know. Everybody, you know, I cannot do the film without the costume designer or the art department or the cinematographer. So it's this collaboration that it's beautiful and we enjoy.
Yeah. Do your films have screenings in Nigeria or in Africa?
Yes.
Oh, good.
You know, one of George was actually screened there before he screened it here.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. So how was it received there?
It was wonderful, you know. People enjoyed it, and I think they enjoyed it.
Yeah, so there wasn't like, I mean, was there discussion about sort of some of the themes?
There was discussion because people can relate to it, and people can, you know, they ask questions, and they relate to it, and, you know, like the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life is never resolved. You know, we go day by day, and the end of the film is that, you know, it's not really resolved.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I'm like, I just want to know. I mean, it could have gone on for a long time. I see how your television series is so widely acclaimed because you just want to keep on going. Okay, well, give me the next episode. I just love these people. I want to know what happens.
You know, we have problems and we do it daily, you know.
Yeah.
It's never the end.
Mm-hmm. Right. It really isn't. And that is, yeah, that I really got to see some more of your films and see if that's how you end them all. Like, it's never the end.
But Restless City on Netflix, I'm sure. You know?
Right, yeah. Well, it's been so lovely talking to you.
You too.
Congratulations on this wonderful work. And I'm going to tell all my friends and tell them to tell their friends.
And tell your audience and everyone to go out and support. It's very important for small movies like this to get an audience, so more movies like this can be out there.
Yes, it is very important that films like this, you continue to make films like this and other films like this continue to be made, because there aren't a lot like this out there.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this wonderful vision that you, you know, were able to hold on to with your collaborators until you were able to get it out there so we could see what you've been working on.
Thank you.
All right, you take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.